The Child. To love anyone, I said, is always to lay upon that person an almost intolerable burden. From The Rose and the Yew Tree by Mary Westmacott. L'amour est en réalité dans le domaine de l'imagination. Quotation from Talleyrand, written on slip and kept by Agatha Christie. In autumn 1918, Archie came home from the war to take up his post at the Air Ministry, and Agatha's real married life began. Her husband had been a creature of fantasy since they met. They had lived at a distance for 6 years, so her ideas about marriage were limited in the extreme, as she wrote in Unfinished Portrait. When people loved each other, they were happy. Unhappy marriages, and of course she knew there were many such, were because people didn't love each other. The book describes the brief and hallowed months before the armistice. Celia and Dermot were so happy together. Their life had a fresh, young ecstasy. They explored their new world of rented flats and legitimized passion like two children in a garden. Married life to them was a game. They played at it enthusiastically. After dinner, the two would sit in front of the fire before going to bed, Dermot with a cup of Ovaltine, Celia with a cup of Bovril. And these were the happiest times of all. Having been, as Celia put it to herself, a little afraid of the stranger in her husband, she now found he was her perfect companion. He was not demonstrative, but she knew he loved her. Sometimes he would clutch her to him and stammer, "Celia, you're so beautiful. So beautiful. Promise me you'll always be beautiful." "You'd love me just the same if I weren't," she replied. Married life began in London. Agatha had gone house hunting as soon as Archie came back to England. At the age of 28, she left Ashfield at last for a flat at Northwick Terrace in St. John's Wood, with a bed full of large iron lumps and a rent of 2.5 guineas a week. Although the Christies had so little money, it did not occur to them to live without staff. They were looked after by Archie's batman, Bartlett, and the general caretaker, Mrs. Woods, who did the serious cooking and handed out advice. She was one of those competent, confident women who Agatha always found impossible to resist. "Fishmonger done you down again, love," Mrs. Woods would say sadly as Agatha, who had never shopped for food in her life, returned with her ladylike basket of substandard groceries. She learned quickly, though. It was fun to learn. Fun to scour the shops for fresh fish and juicy oranges. Fun to take her classes in shorthand and bookkeeping, which might in some unspecified way prove useful. Fun to be a wife. Even poverty was fun in a way. Agatha saw herself and Archie rather like the couple she would portray in her second novel, The Secret Adversary, who end the story engaged to be married. Tommy is an ex-soldier, Tuppence an ex-VAD. Their bright spirits were undimmed by the fact that he is out of work, and she, whose appearance represents a valiant attempt at smartness, must sate her thundering good appetite on dinners of buns. In 1918 there was no thought of a second book, however, as the first, The Mysterious Affair at Stiles, had been swiftly rejected. Various publishers turned it down, including Methwin, Hodder and Stoughton, and what they thought about this later can only be imagined. Certainly somebody might have seen past the immaturities and picked up this young woman's unusual facility for making plots so accessible, so readable. But Agatha's deceptive simplicity would always cause her to be undervalued. In her autobiography she wrote that she hadn't expected success, and in her usual way made light of the writing lark. It is true that she had no acknowledged thought of being a writer, of anything other than an amateur who wrote whatever took her fancy. A poem, a little piece of music, a detective story. Nevertheless, she did not give up on Stiles, and eventually sent it to John Lane and the Bodley Head. But first and foremost, she was Archie's wife. Gentlemen, as she had been taught all her life, required a good deal of looking after. Food was not plentiful at the tail end of war. In her autobiography, Agatha remembered Archie's surprise at her greed when he brought home a vast joint of rationed beef. But she tried hard to replicate the kind of delicacies that had been written into the receipts book. The orange and lemon are placed on hot rashers of bacon, which have been cooked in the meantime. She went to cookery classes and learned to prepare meals for her husband. It was unfortunate that the long, lean Archie could not face Agatha's food when he came home from the ministry in Whitehall. The soufflé would slump as he succumbed to stomach pains, writhing on the bed in agony, then suddenly demanding golden syrup or treacle. Agatha had always been strong and attracted to the fragility in Archie, but she was baffled by the forms it took. He had come home looking the same as ever. The post-war realities were not something for which she was prepared. And she was a little lost, away from Torquay. Almost everyone she knew lived in Devon, and one friend in London, Nan Watts, Madge's sister-in-law, who had married in 1912 but whose husband, Hugo Pollock, had walked out, was so much richer than she that it seemed impossible to socialize with her, although eventually she did visit Nan at her Chelsea home. It was not that Agatha particularly craved friends. She was not the kind of woman to sit and chat with other wives. Despite her pleasure in playing at homemaking, she scorned domestic women, as she wrote in Unfinished Portrait, absorbed in their children, their servants, their house running. She wanted her companionship with Archie, which was magical and precious. But he worked all day, and the days had to be filled. Agatha had always loved the slow stretch of free time, the growth of her imagination within silence and space. But she had been used to thinking and dreaming within the arena of Ashfield, with the hills and sea around her, not on the war-dulled streets of Northwest Eight. This was a very different London from the one she had known as a child, visiting her grandmothers in Bayswater and Ealing. Like Jane Marple, that pink and white eager girl, she had trundled through the streets in a four-wheeler and gazed at the china displays in the Army and Navy stores. Now she no longer looked out from behind a protective screen. Just to walk the streets and go shopping were new to her. So, too, were the impersonality, the anonymity, the crowds of people and the harsh voices. Torquay life had been warm, familiar, structured. Agatha had known everyone, or known people who knew them. She had been Miss Agatha, Miss Miller, with all that that entailed. Mrs. Christie was someone else, unknown even to herself, part of a couple, but also, as a married woman, out on her own. The freedoms were unnerving. Agatha later wrote about the day that peace was declared. She left her shorthand class and went out into the streets quite dazed. There I came upon one of the most curious sights I had ever seen. Indeed, I still remember it, almost, I think, with a sense of fear. Everywhere there were women dancing in the street. One felt that if there had been any Germans around, the women would have advanced upon them and torn them to pieces. Some of them, I suppose, were drunk, but all of them looked it. Lack of control always terrified Agatha. She hated it more than almost anything, having not yet experienced the lethal chill that came when control was absolute, impenetrable. She had seen wayward behaviour during the war, when at the end of her shifts at the hospital, she had had to walk alone at night past the drunken soldiers. But then she had been going home to Ashfield, and once through the garden gate, she had been safe. She was powerfully homesick at the start of her life with Archie. For all that she was deep in love and treating marriage as a grand adventure, a damn good sport, as Tommy calls it in The Secret Adversary, she yearned for dear home. She dreamed of the beech tree and the grass growing, growing against her cheeks, as she lay in the garden, gloriously idle, her head full of thoughts and possibilities and imaginary worlds. "I was slightly lonely," is how she described her feelings in the autobiography. It was in Unfinished Portrait, as always, that she roamed the dreamscape of memory and touched the deeper truths. After the armistice, she and Archie went back to Ashfield, It was lovely to be home. Home looked so much lovelier than she remembered. It was so clean, the spotless cloth for lunch, and the shining silver and the polished glasses. How much one took for granted. She was like a schoolgirl going home for the holidays, chatting excitedly about her life in London, sitting on her mother's bed as she told her about Mrs. Woods and the joint of rationed beef, turning her loneliness into something small and distant. Probably she had never been happier. Such was her delight in being with her husband, for whom she felt a dark and disturbing passion, in this place of sanctuary. She wrote poems at this time. They would be published in 1924 as the Road of Dreams collection, together with earlier works like A Mask from Italy, the youthful verse sequence on the characters of the Commedia dell'arte. Among the later poems was Progression, which began, "Love comes as the spring comes, fearing, dreading. The brown boughs are in blossom. A breath of frost, a wind in the leaves, and the blossom would fall. But close to the earth, the tiny common flowers blossom unheeded." It was during the stay at Asheville that Agatha discovered she was pregnant. The year 1919 was a busy one, beginning with a search for a new home, large enough for a baby, a nanny, and a servant. Decisive as ever, Archie resigned his commission. He was still ambitious for advancement, but took the view, contrary to his previous one, that there was no future for him in the Royal Flying Corps, and that he should instead go into the city. Above all, he was keen to make money. No doubt he looked forward to proving Clara wrong. Relations with his mother-in-law were perfectly good. Miriam told herself that she had been unduly hostile and suspicious, wrote Agatha of the mother in Unfinished Portrait. But Archie would not have been human if he had not resented that implacable opposition to his courting of Agatha. When he set his mind to a thing, it tended to happen. Although he wisely did not resign until he was assured of a job, Archie quickly found work with a man he described as fat and yellow, like the financier Mr. Robinson, who would later feature in several of Agatha's books, and a salary of £500 per annum. This, plus his £80 and Agatha's own 100, gave them sufficient funds. Accommodation was scarce at this time, but eventually they took possession of a 4-bedroom flat at 96 Addison Mansions, near Holland Park, for which they paid £90 a year. It was light and airy, which Agatha loved, and she threw herself into the excitement of decorating it for her new family. Homemaking of this kind would become a passion. Even then, she had clear ideas about what she wanted. Pale paper in the sitting room, a black ceiling covered with hawthorn blossom. It would make me feel, I thought, that I was in the country. And she set to, cheerfully, with her paste and brush. A rented flat in West Kensington was hardly Asheville. Even less was it Abney Hall, with its sumptuous tapestries and green satin walls. But then Archie was so much more attractive than James Watts, and Agatha's marriage so much more lover-like than Madge's. "We were a very ordinary couple," wrote Agatha, with a certain pride. This was down-to-earth London living, buses and trams, bustling along with one's fellow men, an occasional night out at the Palais de Danse in Hammersmith. Money was spent in the ways that seemed natural. Inconceivable to take a taxi or own more than one evening dress, equally odd to live without servants and the precious hours of leisure that they brought. That was the way things were, and they were very good. We were happy. Life seemed well set up for us. Summer and love, stillness, and at the heart of the stillness, a throb. Archie had not wanted the baby, though. In her autobiography, Agatha wrote that he wanted a daughter rather than a son, and only girls' names were discussed. There had been, she said lightly, great arguments. In Unfinished Portrait, the conversation about her pregnancy is odder, the sense of threat deeper. "I hate the thought of a beastly little boy. I shall beat him." And, "I don't want a baby. You'll think of it all the time and not of me. Women do. They're forever becoming domestic and messing about with a baby. They forget about their husbands altogether. And I can't bear it. I've done this to you. I could have prevented it. You might even die. Agatha was violently sick through the whole 9 months. Sickness means girls, said Mrs. Woods. Boys, you go dizzy and faint. Perhaps it was a secret relief to believe this. Agatha wanted Archie to be happy after all. He was extremely kind to her through the pregnancy, despite his dislike of illness. On one occasion, she found a lobster on her pillow, delicious and very expensive, with which he had hoped to tempt her appetite. She devoured the lobster, always one of her favourite foods, and enjoyed it so much that she hardly minded losing it afterwards. In her autobiography, she wrote that she was thrilled about the pregnancy, the conventional, sensible attitude, although she admitted having been very scared. The baby would be born at Ashfield, which was a reassurance. A sensible Torquay doctor, not one of whom she had worked as a VAD, I felt I knew far too much about them, told her not to worry about anything. Death in childbirth was a greater risk at that time, but Agatha was a healthy girl and nature would take its course. But in Unfinished Portrait, Celia's very nerves are sick. She drifts into pregnancy in a state of quiescence, lying back in a chair and listening as Dermot's hatred for his unborn child breaks over her like waves. I was just imagining that the doctor said to me, we can't save both the mother and the child. And I said, hack the child in pieces. Damn it, how brutal of you. Celia is touched in her deepest soul by what she sees as Dermot's anxiety for herself. She does not see his own fear. He craves stability rather than change. He wants Celia to care for him rather than a baby. He needs her to hold his hands and soothe away unspeakable memories. So he is possessed with resentment of the child and, perhaps, of Celia for allowing it to grow inside her. Yet Celia knows that no child could replace Dermot in her heart. She craves her mother at this time, craves what she still thinks of as home, but she is determined to stay with her husband in London. She feels that she might die, and she wasn't going to miss a minute of her time with Dermot. Sick as she was, she still loved Dermot more than ever. Meanwhile, Dermot waits for her to regain the ethereal beauty of her youth and become again the girl for whom he fell. Look at Gladys Cooper. She's had 2 children and she's just as lovely as ever. It's a great consolation to me to think of that.
Dermot, I wish you wouldn't insist so on beauty. It frightens me.
But why? You're going to be beautiful for years and years and years. Eventually, the time came to remove to Ashfield. The baby was due on the 5th of August. Agatha, still sick, travelled to Torquay with Archie. At home, she found Clara and the nurse who had been employed as midwife, like 2 females caught up in the rites of nativity, happy, busy, important, running about with sheets, setting things to order. Agatha herself was lost in the middle of it all, waiting to be initiated into the world of motherhood, feeling not just unready, but unreal. On the night the baby was due, she wandered into her beloved garden, hand in hand with Archie, as if she would have stayed there with him for the rest of her life. Nurse called from the house. You'd better come in now, my dear.
I'm coming.
The next morning, when her daughter was placed in her arms, she wrote that she was now definitely playing the part of the young mother. But she did not feel at all like either a wife or a mother. She felt like a little girl come home after an exciting but tiring party. This is the person at the heart of Unfinished Portrait, who deals in adulthood and remains a child. She does not engage with life except in her imagination. She lives as if she had invented herself as one of the girls, whose fate is to marry a mysterious man with whom she will be happy ever after. That does not mean life will not touch her. Her vulnerability to life is acute,
precisely because she is so remote from reality. Much later, in the Mary Westmacott novel The Rose and the Yew Tree, Agatha considered the difference between those people who live their lives and those, like Celia, who watch themselves living them. I remembered vaguely as a child going carefully and unsteadily down a big flight of stairs. I could hear the faint echo of my own voice saying importantly, "Here's Hugh going downstairs." Later, a child learns to say, "I." But somewhere deep inside himself, that I doesn't penetrate. He goes on not being I, but a spectator. He sees himself in a series of pictures. I had seen Hugh comforting Jennifer, Hugh being all the world to Jennifer, Hugh going to make Jennifer happy. Then Hugh, the narrator of The Rose and the Yew Tree, thinks about other people he knows, who similarly see themselves as figures in their own emotional dramas, falling in love with people for whom their feelings are illusory, being kind to people about whom they do not really care, playing at life. Finally, he thinks about his sister-in-law Teresa, who, although young, is wise, brave, and willing to deal in realities. Here's Teresa, marrying Robert. Here's Teresa... No, that wouldn't work. Teresa, I thought to myself, was adult. She had learned to say, I. Agatha did not say I. She knew that she did not, which was why the idea fascinated her so much in The Rose and the Yew Tree. Back in 1919, she gave birth, she found a flat in which to live, she decorated it, she interviewed nannies, she found a competent woman named Jessie Swannell, she created a grown-up world in which to live with Archie. And she saw it all still through the veil that had been flung so magically across the whole of her childhood. Here is Agatha cooking for her husband. Here is Agatha smiling at her daughter Rosalind. Here is Agatha sending out cards. Mrs. Archibald Christie returns thanks for kind inquiries and congratulations. Here is Agatha walking up the four flights of stairs to her family home. Only when she had been lying in bed at Ashfield, with the baby in the care of the nurse and her mother by her side, only then had she been I. She had held Clara's hand as she fell asleep. "Don't go away, Mummy." "No, darling, I'm going to sit here by you." Perhaps no writer learns to say I. Perhaps if they did, they would no longer be writers. But the Agatha of 1919 had lost all thought of writing. She had, as she wrote much later, quite given up hope of ever having a book published. The letter from the Bodley Head, asking her to visit the office and discuss the mysterious affair at Stiles, dropped out of the sky as from nowhere. It arrived just after the birth of Rosalind. 18 months after the manuscript had been sent out, there she was, this attractive young mother, this ladylike figure, quite the most unlikely person to know about the properties of strychnine and bromide, sitting opposite John Lane, a real-life publisher, who looked to me like an old-fashioned sea captain with his small grey beard and twinkling blue eyes. And here he was, saying that her manuscript might have, I only say might have, possibilities. The court scene would have to go, of course, and some other rewriting would be needed. Then publication might just happen. John Lane did a clever job on Agatha, recognizing both a talent and an easy touch when he saw one. By making her feel grateful and emphasizing the need for alterations, he tied her into a contract for 5 more books with the Bodley Head, at a royalty rate only slightly above the one being offered for Stiles, which was 10% on any English sale of more than 2,000 copies. She barely noticed this clause, as she had absolutely no thought of writing 5 more books. Later she wrote, "It was the beginning of my career." But she really did not see it that way at the time. Her life now was with Archie and Rosalind. She was a wife and mother with a home to run. She would remain an amateur, writing for fun, when and if she chose. That night, the Christies celebrated her piece of luck at the Palais de Danse. The next day, it was back to the park with Rosalind. Agatha did not especially enjoy the long walk through Kensington with the pram. It was tiring, and when you got there you couldn't sit still and rest and make your mind a blank. But she was proud of Rosalind, a beautiful dark-haired child, very much like Archie in looks. The name came from As You Like It. Agatha later named herself after Celia in the same play, and was the choice of both parents, although before the birth, Agatha had wanted Martha, after her father's American mother, while Archie had shown himself a reader of Idylls of the King in favouring Enid and Elaine. But Rosalind was no lily maid of Astolat, living in fantasy. She was practical, pragmatic, with almost no use for imagination. Like her Shakespearean namesake, she had a near-masculine boldness of character. She was, in fact, her father's daughter. And Archie, who had taken no interest in Rosalind as a baby, "Once she can talk and walk, I dare say I shall like her," says Dermot in Unfinished Portrait, found himself drawn to this intelligent and self-possessed little person whose natural delight was to engage with reality. From the first, Rosalind was able to say, "I." Always she took life as it was. She had no need or desire to dream of other worlds. This fascinated Agatha, but at the same time confounded her. In Unfinished Portrait, she dreams of the day when she will take Judy home to her own mother. Judy would play in the garden and invent games of princesses and dragons, and Celia would read her all the old fairy stories in the nursery bookcase. When she takes Judy home, however, there are no invented games in the garden. Judy wasn't any good at make-believe. When Celia told Judy how she herself had pretended that the lawn was a sea and her hoop a river horse, Judy had merely stared and said, "But it's grass, and you bowl a hoop. You can't ride it." It was so obvious that she thought Celia must have been a rather silly little girl that Celia felt quite dashed. But for all her admiration of the bright-spirited Judy, Celia's own mother thinks differently. "She's not you, my precious." This is how Clara thought of Agatha. Their relationship was one of absolute understanding, unconditional acceptance. Clara loved the silly little girl in her daughter. She had not wanted her to marry Archie, partly because she had sensed that he would be ruthless with Agatha's silliness. At the same time, she wanted Agatha to be happy, which meant accepting the marriage to Archie. Now, with the birth of Rosalind, Clara tried to give Agatha advice on how to hold her husband. She warned her not to leave Archie alone, to put him first, to make him feel the most important thing in her life. "Remember, a man forgets." She spoke the words of Margaret Miller, knowing they were not cynicism but sober sense. Agatha knew it too, but she felt no need to apply them to her own life. It was not that Clara expected the marriage to go wrong. She simply worked in the interests of Agatha's happiness, seeing as she did that her daughter's dangerous intensity of affection required the same in return. Agatha was not mature or realistic enough to live with a mere formal family union, the kind of marriage that Madge now had. She needed love. In Unfinished Portrait, the mother says more. She tells Celia to put Dermot before Judy. She tells her that there had been struggles, even in her own marriage, between her love for her children and for her husband. "You care for Dermot so much, and children take you away from a man. They are supposed to bring you together. But it isn't so. No, it isn't so." It was the Clara character who spoke these words, but it was Agatha's own view that was being expressed. This was the irony. It was Archie who had feared the birth of their child, and Agatha who probably should have done so. Agatha already had two intense relationships in her life, with her husband and her mother. Although she would never have admitted it, she had little emotional room for a child. She had married a man with whom she was passionately in love, Like Caroline Crail in her novel Five Little Pigs, she had an unusually attractive husband and a small daughter, and the daughter inevitably came second in her heart. As the governess, Miss Williams, put it, Mrs. Crail was really completely wrapped up in her husband. She existed, one might say, only in him and for him. The Crail child is treated with affection, but, says Miss Williams, a child in such a marriage hardly seems very real to its parents. Hence Archie's inability to get to grips with Agatha's pregnancy and Agatha's own passivity throughout. Not fully acknowledged in the autobiography, laid bare in Unfinished Portrait. Later, of course, Archie's attitude changed. Rosalind became a champion to him, cleaning his golf clubs with an intent frown and sharing his dry sense of humour. She was, he told Agatha, perfect. But Agatha did not need a perfect child. She herself was perfect to Clara. And so in love was she with being a daughter's a daughter all your life, that she was unable to find true fulfilment as a mother. Just as Clara had reacted to being given away as a child by becoming a possessive, powerful force in the lives of Agatha and Madge, so Agatha reacted to all that maternal love by detaching herself from her own daughter. Could she ever have conjured again the close perfection of her relationship with Clara? Would she have wanted to? Rosalind's independent spirit, her reluctance to be hugged, her disdain for imaginative play were almost a relief to Agatha. They removed the obligation to try to replicate the bond between herself and Clara, which would have been impossible anyway. Instead, Agatha could view Rosalind at an affectionate distance, telling herself that they were simply unalike. And as Rosalind's self-sufficiency developed, so too did Agatha's objectivity. With a son, she might have been different, although, of course, Archie had not wanted a son. A child, she wrote in her autobiography, is yours, and yet is mysteriously a stranger. It is like a strange plant which you have brought home, planted, and can hardly wait to see how it will turn out. This is wildly at odds with contemporary thinking, which tends to believe that a child's development is within the control of its parents, an idea that even Clara Miller, so dominant an influence upon the lives of her daughters, would have balked at. She knew very well the importance of leaving a child to occupy its own imaginative spaces. Agatha felt more strongly still. Many children, most children, I should say, suffer from over-attention on the part of their parents, says Miss Williams in Five Little Pigs. There is too much love, too much watching over the child. The best thing for a child, I am convinced, is to have what I should term healthy neglect on the part of both of its parents. This was Agatha's considered opinion. There was nothing in her of the sentimental mother, although through her communication with Clara's emotions, she could feel sentimental about herself. Such was her complexity that she could be in love with her own childhood, yet turn a cool eye upon children in general, and her own daughter in particular. At the age of 13, she had written in the album of confessions of her desire to be surrounded by babies and cats. As an adult, she believed, or so she wrote in her autobiography, that an honest mother would treat her offspring as a cat does, take satisfaction in giving birth, nurture for a little, then move back into her own life. Is it really natural to go on caring about your young once they're grown up and out into the world? Animals don't. The idea was in The Moving Finger, which has a character disliked by her own mother. Only mothers can't say they don't want their children and just go away, or eat them. Cats eat the kittens they don't like. Awfully sensible, I think. No waste or mess. But human mothers have to keep their children. This is a continual refrain in her books, so much so that it takes on a faint note of defiance. Lots of mothers don't like their children, she wrote in The Moving Finger and in Crooked House. Again and again a mother takes a dislike to one of her children. She consistently refuses to take the orthodox line, as expressed by this character in Halloween Party. I like all children. Most people do. Agatha agrees with Hercule Poirot, who replies, "Ah, there I do not agree with you. Some children I consider are most unattractive." The person who likes all children has, in fact, murdered a girl of 12 by sticking her head in a bucket full of water. In Agatha Christie, there is no shirking the fact that children are killed, even by their own mothers. "There was Mrs. Green, you know. She buried 5 children, and every one of them insured. Well, naturally, one began to get suspicious." They can also kill. Agatha created 2 child murderers, a child suspected of murder, and in Peril at End House, a child who happily tells Captain Hastings that, "I seen a pig killed. I liked it." In other words, she sternly refused to see children as different from adults. Their character was formed at an early age. It did not really change, and it was just as likely to be nasty as nice. We are all the same people as we were at 3, 6, 10, or 20 years old, as she put it in her autobiography. If a child was as charming as Miranda Butler in Halloween Party, then both she and Poirot said so. If not, not. The haze through which Agatha saw her own young self cleared instantly when she looked at other children. Her views on motherhood remained utterly separate from her feelings for Clara. Exemplary maternity is as thin on the ground in Agatha Christie as it is in the plays of Shakespeare. "Julia's quite an ordinary sort of child," says a mother at the girls' school in Cat Among the Pigeons. "I think she's got reasonably good brains, too. But I dare say mothers usually think that about their children, don't they?" "Mothers," said Miss Bulstrode grimly, "vary." In fact, Julia Upjohn's mother is one of the few of whom Agatha approves. "Mummy's gone to Anatolia on a bus," Julia tells Miss Bulstrode. The child said it exactly as though she were saying her mother had taken a 73 bus to Marshall and Snellgrove's when Mrs. Upjohn disappears on a tour of the East. This was very much the sort of thing that Agatha herself would later do. "When are you coming home?" the 10-year-old Rosalind wrote, resignedly, from her boarding school. So Mrs. Upjohn is presented as perfectly normal, a refreshingly sane contrast to the kind of mothers who loom too large in the lives of their children. "I think when your children have grown up, that you should cut away from them, efface yourself, slink away, force them to forget you," says a character in Crooked House. Her view is portrayed as extreme, but not completely unacceptable, since Agatha makes clear that the family in Crooked House has been damaged by its stifling closeness. "Motherhood, unrelenting," she wrote in N or M, in a tone not unlike that which described her deep unease at the street celebrations on Armistice Day. Motherhood, too, implied a lack of control, a lack of rationality, as her own mother-in-law had proved. Agatha had near contempt for the way in which biology could take over personality. Bella Tanyos in Dumb Witness is despised as definitely a dreary woman, rather like an earwig. She's a devoted mother. So are earwigs, I believe. Gerda Christo in The Hollow is equally devoted and equally dull. They are like the women described in The Man in the Brown Suit, who talked for hours of themselves and their children and of the difficulties of getting good milk for the children. They were stupid, stupid even at their chosen job. In the Westmacott novels, Joan Scudamore, in Absent in the Spring, is a perfect mother, the kind that would be admired today. She involves herself in every aspect of her 3 children's lives, and not one of them can wait to escape her well-intentioned clutches. She'd wanted her children to have the best of things, but what was the best? Then there is Anne Prentice in A Daughter's a Daughter, who turns down the chance at a second marriage because her daughter Sarah dislikes the man. Anne makes the sacrifice for Sarah, but finds herself filled with uncontainable resentment. "Why do you hate me, Mother?" "I've given up my life for you, given up everything I cared for. You were my own daughter, my own flesh and blood. I chose you. And ever since then, you've hated me." Women who sacrifice their own lives for their children failed to understand, as the infinitely wise and childless Dame Laura Whitstable says in A Daughter's a Daughter, that a sacrifice is not merely a gesture. It is something you have to live with afterwards, all day and every day. This can only lead to unhappiness. Detachment is therefore the better choice. Mother are the devil. Why have they got to brood over their children? Why do they feel they know all about their children? They don't. They don't. Perhaps the supreme example of this is Rachel Argyle in Ordeal by Innocence. She is haunted by her own infertility and adopts 5 children in an attempt to sate her longings. Mrs. Argyle had been blinded by her intense maternal possessiveness, thinks her housekeeper Kirsten Lindstrom, who had seen the adopted children not as angels of innocence or extensions of her own egotism, but as individuals, as themselves, with all their faults and virtues. Women like Mrs. Argyle were difficult for her to understand. Crazy about a lot of children who were not her own and treating her husband as though he were not there. A kind of living, walking embodiment of mother knows best. And not really even a mother. If she had ever borne a child, it might have kept her humble. This last sentence shows Agatha's somber respect for the realities of motherhood and for those women who recognize them. Like Renesmee in her ancient Egyptian novel Death Comes as the End, who says of her daughter, "She is not me, and she is not Kai. She is herself. She is Teti. If there is love between us, we shall be friends all our life. But if there is not love, she will grow up, and we shall be strangers. She is Teti, and I am Renesmee." What enraged Agatha was the diffuse emotionalism that mothers tended to throw around the subject, the pretense that fulfilling a biological function somehow turned them into so many Virgin Marys. Even worse were the Rachel Argyles, who thought that they could buy into these feelings from the outside, as it were. "I know heaps of mothers who hate their daughters like poison," says Sarah in A Daughter's a Daughter. Her defiant petulance is Agatha's too. But the real anger went deeper, and was to do with Agatha's own self. She was no longer the child. She was no longer at the center of her own life. And she wanted to be, although the sensible side of her knew this was absurd. So she was enraged, too, by what she knew to be her own shortcomings. She was unable to be the kind of mother that Clara had been to her. Her insistence upon objectivity was, in a sense, self-justification. It was right not to be blinded by love for one's children, right not to give up one's life to them, right to see them objectively. So her books kept telling her. They also, of course, told her that Clara's adoration of herself and Madge was wrong-headed, even dangerous. But the paradox did not bother her. Her relationship with Clara was perfect. Her relationship with Rosalind was compounded of love, regret, bafflement, and jealousy. Ironically, the jealousy that Archie had expected to feel. And no maternal instinct arose to resolve these ambiguities. The emotional capacity that lay within Agatha could never quite direct itself towards her daughter. In 1930, she sent a letter from Ashfield to her second husband, Max, full of news about Rosalind and Peter, her wire-haired terrier. "Peter is my child, you know." Agatha's second book, The Secret Adversary, was written for money at Archie's suggestion. He was not the kind of man to object to a wife who wrote books, although this was really very unusual in 1920. He did not interfere in Agatha's private thoughts and doings. In fact, in Unfinished Portrait, she wrote that she wished he had interfered more. "Do you mind very much, Dermot, my being dreamy and fancying things and imagining things that might happen and what I should do if they did?" "Of course I don't mind, if it amuses you." Dermot was always fair. He was independent himself, and he respected independence in other people. The trouble was that Celia wanted to share everything. This was not absolutely true of Agatha, who had her own cravings for solitude. but she loved her companionship with Archie and did not want to lose it, even as the layers of self-sufficiency grew around the man who had written in 1913 of feeling so lonely. I miss you more than ever this time, and feel so lost without having you near me. But in Unfinished Portrait, after the birth of their child, Dermot takes Celia to bed and says in his old, diffident way, I still love you frightfully, Celia. Lovers. Yes, they were still lovers, thinks Celia. A photograph, taken at the end of 1919, on the day of Archie's investiture at Buckingham Palace, shows the Christies walking down a London street together. Agatha is in a dark suit, Archie in a long overcoat. Both are tall and slim and rather glamorous. They look alike, in the way that close couples do, although they walk some distance apart.